cities, so protesters railing against the vaccine passports that are now required to access much of public life. The largest demonstration was held in the Italian capital, Rome, where over 5,000 people gathered in iconic St. John's Square to express their anger at the Mario Draghi government's latest COVID restrictions. The new law has expanded the scope of the National Health Pass, which now can only be obtained through vaccination or recovery from the infection. Italy's public transport, restaurants, hotels, museums, gyms and leisure places are required to check the pass before providing their services to the citizens.
We are not against the vaccine. My daughters and I have been vaccinated. Furthermore, we don't hold it against the Italian fellow citizens who got vaccinated. It was their choice and we respect it. We are sick and tired of being considered just numbers for statistics. We are human beings, citizens, with our rights and freedoms.
The organizers of the protest say they are not supporting the no-vax movement, but are very concerned over the socio-economic consequences of the restrictions. Thousands of small and medium-sized companies that make up the bulk of the Italian economy have been forced to shut down due to the coronavirus lockdowns.
Retailers, shopkeepers, everybody knows full well that the new restrictions will hit them even harder. Scientific experts have explained that the vaccine offers partial protection against transmission or of infection from the virus. This green pass is just a way to control us.
Despite Italy recording over 180,000 COVID-related cases on Saturday, the daily number of reported coronavirus infections in Italy has begun to fall in recent days. However, scientific experts say the Omicron wave has not peaked just yet.
On top of the pandemic's socioeconomic effects, Italy is bracing for the upcoming presidential election. Lawmakers will elect the country's next president on January 24, with current Prime Minister Mario Draghi among the contenders. The possibility of a government crisis cannot be ruled out. Max Civili, Rome.
The U.S. levied sanctions on six North Korean officials and two organizations following Washington's rebukes of Pyongyang at the United Nations. North Korea conducted several ballistic missile tests over the past week, including two Friday afternoon. But North Korea's ally China believes the sanctions raise tension. Since sanctions began 15 years ago, North Korea has developed a credible nuclear threat. Pyongyang argues that it has a right to self-defense in the face of U.S. hostility, which includes military exercises of the 28,500 U.S. troops in South Korea. The U.S.-led U.N. Security Council sanctions against North Korea seek to encourage Pyongyang to negotiate denuclearization.
The UN Security Council sanctions against North Korea are being carried out mainly by the US and Japan, along with several other countries. Hence, if the US and Japan truly seek the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, they should stop sanctions and conduct dialogue and diplomacy with North Korea.
South Korea also favors sanctions relief for North Korea, with its unification ministry Friday vowing to continue efforts at providing humanitarian aid. South Korea has also called for an official declaration to end the 1950-53 Korean War, although the U.S. has shown little interest. South Korean President Moon Jae-in has made repeated attempts to bring the U.S. and North Korea together for a meaningful dialogue. But with Moon's term set to expire this May, this last round of U.S. sanctions will likely deal a final blow to President Moon's peace-building efforts. Frank Smith, Seoul.
At a press conference in Moscow, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov touched not only on negotiations with the West, but also the peacekeeping operation in Kazakhstan and the upcoming meeting of the presidents of Iran and Russia.
The visit, in short, is very important. It's time to resume contacts at the highest level, which are traditionally close and regular among us, and which also fell victim to the coronavirus infection. The significance of the visit, first of all, is the need to take an inventory of our entire agenda, taking into account considering the new government in Iran.
Russians.
Lavrov added that Moscow is in favor of holding a conference on security in the Persian Gulf, where it would be possible to discuss the claims accumulated both by Iran against its Arab neighbors and by its Arab neighbors against the Islamic Republic.
Such forum can unite Iranians and Arabs. Each of the parties would put their concerns on the table. They would also talk about their concerns over Yemen, Syria, Iraq, and other volatile areas that somehow cause controversy between other countries.
Regarding relations with the West, Russia has come up with offers of security guarantees as its patience has run out. Moscow is waiting for the West to give a concrete and written answer to its initiative and is not going to wait indefinitely. Last month, Russia's foreign ministry published draft security proposals between Moscow and Washington on ensuring the security of Russia and NATO member states. Consultations on these issues were held on January 10th in Geneva, a session of the NATO-Russia Council was held on January 12th in Brussels, and a meeting of the OSCE Permanent Council took place on January 13th in Vienna.
The appearance of NATO on the Russian borders is categorically unacceptable. This is a real red line. The appearance of U.S. weapons and military bases there on the Sea of Azov is the second red line. It simply reflects the West's overreach, to put it bluntly, in violation of all obligations, in violation of common sense.
Lavrov said NATO had come ever closer to Russia's borders during five waves of expansion starting 1997, when it formalized its relations with NATO. The diplomat said it absolutely cannot suit Russia when it is required to send troops to barracks on its territory, while at the same time the Americans, the Canadians and the British are building bases in Ukraine and the Black Sea region.
Russia's efforts to strengthen ties with its neighbors demonstrate differences between the CSTO and NATO. Russia and its allies leave countries at the end of military missions, thus establishing strategic partnerships. And regarding unfriendly policies adopted by Western governments towards Russia, Moscow advocates for constructive dialogue and mutual respect. Марина Картунова, Moscow.
India's Supreme Court has notified the northern state of Uttarakhand and New Delhi authorities to investigate the recent incidents of vicious hate speeches by several Hindu religious leaders, which called for Muslim genocide. The petitioner stated such incidents, if not addressed with the rule of law, pose a grave threat not just to the unity and integrity of the country, but also endanger the lives of millions of Muslim citizens. Activists call it encouraging move.
The Muslims of this country, when they decided to stay back and not migrate to Pakistan, the reason was that they believed in a system which is not based on any religion, which a constitution, an idea of India which is plural, which is diverse, which respects each and every citizen equally.
Since the partition of the subcontinent in 1947, Indian Muslims have been subjected to widespread discrimination, but it all swelled after the emergence of BJP in 2014. The community has been subjected to deliberate vicious hate campaigns and violence. Several Muslim organizations accuse the government of Prime Minister Modi of turning blind eye towards the issue. Last few years have been overly violent, considering the growing hostility towards the community. Experts say this could tear apart social harmony in a diversified country which has a long-standing history of terrific communal violence. Anti-Muslim sentiments have risen extensively. Since last few years, Hindu mobs have unleashed striking attacks on Muslims, lynched dozens of people, mainly Muslims and Dalits, accusing them of indistinct activities in addition to other systematic repression. Activists call it the pretext of a larger political agenda to turn India into a supremacist Hindu nation.
This is part of the larger design. I mean, it is not that they are doing it on their own. They know that they have state patronage. They have patronage from the political party, the BJP and the RSS, and so they are emboldened.
As India's state elections draw near, anti-Muslim rhetoric is flaring across the country, which experts call a political gimmick to polarize the community, therefore playing a divide-and-rule policy. Activists, however, maintain that resistance to the violent and divisive politics is also growing. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
This is the first time Hossein Amir Abdullahian visited China as Iran's foreign minister. The one-day trip came upon an invitation by his Chinese counterpart, Wang Yi. The visit marked the beginning of the implementation of the much-anticipated Sino-Iranian pact known as the 25-year strategic partnership.
In this trip, we agreed to start implementing the 25-year comprehensive strategic cooperation agreement. I also delivered a written message from our president to his Chinese counterpart, Mr. Xi, to implement the agreement.
The Sino-Iranian Comprehensive Strategic Partnership was announced in a joint statement during a visit by Chinese President Xi Jinping to Iran in 2016. In 2020, Wang Yi and then-Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif signed the pact in Tehran. So far, no detailed information has been revealed from the agreement, but the two sides say it covers economic, political, and security areas.
During today's meeting, we talked about industrial, scientific, technological, and economic areas, as well as tourism and other subjects that are covered by the 25-year agreement.
During the talks, China also reiterated its support for Iran's nuclear rights in the ongoing Vienna talks, aimed at removing U.S. sanctions, which Washington reinstated against Iran in 2018 after it unilaterally left the 2015 deal. As signatories to the accord, China and Russia both urge Washington to remove the sanctions as the only path to rejoin the deal.
Today, we extensively discussed the Vienna talks over the removal of U.S. sanctions on Iran. China's representative in Vienna, along with his Russian counterpart, plays a positive part in advocating Iran's nuclear rights and the removal of the anti-Iran sanctions.
China is Iran's number one trade partner. This partnership heavily relies on Iran's oil supply to energy-hungry China. Reports show that in 2021, and despite U.S. oil embargoes on Iran, China tripled its oil imports from Iran. Now the implementation of the new pact will guarantee the flow of Iran's oil to China and cement the two sides' trade ties. It goes without saying that China and Iran are strategic partners in every sense. And the top Iranian diplomat's trip is a sign that Tehran is determined to keep that path with Beijing. The two sides are expected to engage even more as the 25-year strategic partnership has moved from paper to practice. Yusuf Jalali from the Chinese city of Wuxi.
If you want to keep warm this winter and can't afford to keep your heating on, wear an extra layer. Do star jumps or hug your pet for warmth, if you have one, that is. 3 of 10 recommendations from Britain's third largest energy supplier to British households. Some of the Britons we talked to had this to say in response.
Disgusting. Probably just like what most people think, to be fair. And if you're anybody like me who's suffering in a house with mold, damp, and excessive cold anyway, with uninsulated houses, then it's even 10 times worse, so.
It's absolutely horrendous. Because, I mean, I saw something on the news the other day where one energy company was saying, you know, get yourself a pet to keep you warm. Did you see that? And all this sort of nonsense. I mean, how are people going to manage?
The company's founder has since apologized, but he also said this.
Globally, energy prices are going up, and we need a system that consumers pay the true cost of energy. There is no way to magically make that lower.
There may not be a magical way of pushing energy prices down, but there must be something the government can do to contain the situation, like a working energy strategy.
And the simplest way of doing it would actually be measure it according to income. So those who've got more wealth and the broadest shoulders should pay most, and those who can't afford to pay least and get protected by the rest of society. But at the moment, no one's doing anything.
With barely any rise in their income and faced with rising taxes, millions of British households are shaking at the prospect of a nearly 50% increase in their energy bills in spring. Since October last year, the energy price cap set by industry regulator Ofgem has been at more than $1,700. That is expected to change in April by nearly $1,000 when Ofgem sets the new cap, resulting in British homeowners' energy bills rising significantly.
You're going to see pressure on the weakest this year, and that's what's so unfair. There'll be more discontent. Does it mean there'll be riots and things like that? No, but there'll probably be demonstrations of people concerned about the level of poverty.
While the British government drags its feet on dealing with the looming cost of living catastrophe caused by stalling wages and rising tax and energy bills, less fortunate Britons will have a tough winter to battle through, with or without a pet for warmth. Saeed Purizza, London.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Kavitat Wade. On Saturday, the Yemeni army issued a warning against the UAE, one of the partners in the Saudi alliance in the war on Yemen. The United Arab Emirates, UAE, should await a harsh response for its escalations against Yemen. It reminded the Persian Gulf country that Abu Dhabi's fragile glass towers are, quote, easy to reach. That reach was executed just 2 days later. Yemen's army launched drone attacks deep inside the UAE. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at whether the UAE and Saudi Arabia, for that matter, will change course in this war or continue with their failed offensives.
The Yemeni army and its allied Ansarullah forces have hit the heart of the United Arab Emirates, with officials in Abu Dhabi confirming two fire incidents near storage facilities of an oil firm and the city's international airport. It came just days after the Yemeni army repelled an attack by Emirati-backed mercenaries in the province of Ma'rib, killing and injuring dozens. In a statement, the Yemeni army says Monday's attack inside the UAE was a warning to stop its involvement in the Saudi-led war on the country. Earlier this month, the Yemeni army released footage of a captured UAE-flagged vessel, which had trespassed into the country's territorial waters. Army spokesman Yahya Sari said the ship was carrying military equipment and was engaged in hostile acts against Yemen. The UAE joined the Saudi-led coalition in 2015 in order to reinstate a friendly regime in Yemen. In April 2018, the Emirates deployed its military to Socotra, an island that overlooks the strategic Bab el-Mandab Strait, a main shipping route connecting the Red Sea to the Gulf of Aden and the Arabian Sea. 2 weeks later, Saudi troops were also deployed there, a move the Yemenis described as a coup against legitimacy. The UAE had largely scaled down its military presence in Yemen in 2019, but continued funding, arming, and training mercenaries in support of separatists in southern Yemen. It became quite clear when forces loyal to former Yemeni government, aided by UAE-backed brigades and Saudi warplanes, reclaimed the oil and gas-rich southern province of Shabwa earlier this month and made advances toward Ma'rib province. However, the Yemeni army's repeated retaliatory drone and missile attacks inside Saudi Arabia and now in the UAE show the coalition is losing the momentum. It has also inflicted heavy losses on Saudi and Emirati-backed militias operating inside the country. Since last year, the Yemeni army, along with Ansarullah forces, have liberated nearly 20,000 square kilometers of land in several large-scale operations. Nearly 7 years of bombing campaigns and blockade on Yemen have proved fruitless for Saudi Arabia and some of its regional and international allies, including the U.S., as they fail to achieve their intended goals. On the other hand, Yemen's armed forces and the popular comedies have grown stronger against the invaders and give them crushing response to their deadly mayhem in the impoverished nation.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the Spotlight, we have activist and political analyst Hossein Al-Bukhaiti joining us from Sana'a. Also joining us, journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier joining us from Brussels.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome to you both, and Hossein Al-Bukhaiti, let me first start with you. You had a warning that was issued by the Yemeni army And then two days later, Abu Dhabi was hit. Drone attacks deep inside the UAE, 3 fuel tankers in this incident. And it took place in your storage facilities of the ADNOC, which is the oil firm of the UAE. Tell us how significant this is, and tell us why the Yemeni army decided to choose this time for it to execute this attack.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. They have chosen this time because the United Arab Emirates have declared a long time ago that they have withdrawn from Yemen and they are not involved in the war. But actually, in the recent week, United Arab Emirates has extended its attack and its strike on Yemen. They have resumed their attack. Hundreds of airstrikes targeted Yemeni civilians in Shabwa region. And United Arab Emirates' role in Yemen is no different than Saudi Arabia. But on the top of that, they actually supporting separatists. They're trying to divide Yemen, controlling Yemeni island and some of the coast of Yemen, building air base there. So United Arab Emirates' goal is to divide Yemen, and then they will try to be, or they are actually a tool of the United States and the Zionist state of Israel. What's new about this latest attack on the United Arab Emirates? That comes after 3 or 4 days after Yemeni official here in Sana'a have warned United Arab Emirates if they are not going to stop their attack, that they will be under a target. And as Yahya Sari', the spokesperson of Yemeni army, he have declared United Arab Emirates as unsafe state, and he has as well called foreign company to leave the country, because at one point Yemeni army will target Abu Dhabi airport directly and will target many industrial area in United Arab Emirates. We have seen that United Arab Emirates has admitted that attack because I believe they could not hide it, as they did when Yemeni forces 3 years ago have targeted Abu Dhabi airport. United Arab Emirates have denied at that time, but then Sana'a has released CCTV footage from the airport that shows that attack. And this is the first time Yemeni army used a ballistic missile to target, as they say, Abu Dhabi airport and Dubai airport, including as well refinery and other sensitive and important area in United Arab Emirates. That's why I believe that United Arab Emirates is still hiding some of the damage that have been done today by Yemeni attack.
Sure, that has actually been reflected in some media outlets. But Elijah Magner, our guest there, talked about how one of the reasons, anyways, for the attack is that the UAE announced a couple years ago, that it was withdrawing from the war in Yemen. That its strategy in that war has changed, and it announces the end of its direct military engagement there. Why do you think that the UAE would do that and yet continue with this war while it's still evident that it's participating, and at the same time it was at least covered in a way where it said it was a fatal blow to its relationship to Saudi Arabia?
This is a very good question. Actually, the Emirates have said that in the past, and not only after the attack on the Emirates, we saw the Stockholm Agreement coming out in 2018, establishing a ceasefire and redeployment of forces because they were critical to ease humanitarian crisis. The second point of the Stockholm Agreement was the opening humanitarian corridor to allow to facilitate the freedom of movement of civilian and goods. And the last point is the prisoner swap. So nothing has changed. We haven't seen very little of prisoner swap, and we've seen very little of ceasefire, redeployment of forces, and humanitarian corridor. The siege is still established against Yemen, and the Emirates did not respect the Stockholm Agreement, and it's pushed by the Saudis to continue the war because the Saudis insist, notwithstanding all the losses they on the Saudi economy, and on losing on the ground with all its mercenaries. So because the Emirates jumped in again, then the Houthis warned the Emiratis that there is a price for what you're going to do. Mm-hmm. And the Houthis warning was very serious. We've seen it today, but what is very surprising is how the world jumped on one attack against the Emirates when on the same day, there were 38 attacks from the Saudis and coalition against Yemen. So there is really nothing that is balanced on the mainstream media, and the war in Yemen is looked at from only one angle against the Yemeni, sure, and in favor of the Saudis. At the end of the day, the Saudis and Yemeni are occupying Yemen. They should leave.
Well, that's a very good point that you make. The fact that you have 38 attacks take place. Listen to Bukhati, our guest, talking about that. That's not covered, where you have this one attack and you have a blitz of media coverage on this. Do you think that is because of the fact that UAE is small? It's a haven for what you have, the presence of foreign investors, real estate sectors, and basically port exports, and all different foreigners and expats in that small island. You have the world somewhat engaged in one way or another with that island. And that is why you have the coverage that you have, which at this point, this particular attack may actually threaten overall its economy.
Yes, I mean, if you see that United Arab Emirates, its economy and its industry, its focus on Dubai and Abu Dhabi. That's why I believe if Yemeni army will continue its attack, United Arab Emirates will be affected more than Saudi Arabia, because we know the size of Saudi Arabia is big, and as well, United Arab Emirates depend 95% of its economy on the export of oil, and the other 5% is on tourists, and there are millions of foreigners who live in United Arab Emirates, tens of thousands of foreign company. That's why we have seen as well, if you check the so-called flight radar app, you're going to see there are less flight on United Arab Emirates. Just 1 hour ago, there were two flights, one from Doha and one from Istanbul, has actually directed its flight away from Abu Dhabi Airport, and this means that the damage that has been done to the airport, and maybe the companies and flight companies will think again to use that airport and as well Dubai Airport. That's why I believe more attack against United Arab Emirates, against its airport, against its economy, it will bring it to its knee faster than Saudi Arabia, and then Yemeni army will be actually able to liberate more areas in Yemen. And just one final thing, I have seen in many media, outside media especially, they call that today attack as an escalation. They have forgot that Yemen is under attack for more than 7 years. Hundreds of thousands of Yemeni civilians has been killed. The blockade, the constant attack on Yemeni industry, on Yemeni infrastructure. That's why we have come to a point, an eye for an eye. But even though Yemeni army is still careful in taking and deciding when to attack, and there was as well about 10 minutes ago two airstrike on Sana'a. That's why I believe the coming days we will see more attack against United Arab Emirates if they are not going to stop their war against Yemen.
Well, okay, I guess we do need to talk about this, Elijah Magnier. I mean, you know, our guest makes a very good point. You have a country that's being bombed rather continuously in the past 3 weeks. It has escalated this bombing campaign by Saudi Arabia and the Saudi-led coalition. And not to mention the past years that the country is experiencing not only the bombing campaign, civilian deaths, but the humanitarian aspect. But the scant coverage, not only on that aspect of it, but the way that it gets twisted, as if this one attack that took place today is heightening or escalating the war. So the media is trying to twist this story towards the other side, isn't it?
Yes, of course. I mean, let's start from the Biden administration, when President Biden came to power and said he wanted to stop the war in Yemen. And then he backed off on that, and he's no longer concerned about stopping the devastating war on Yemen and the huge, biggest ever humanitarian crisis that hit the country. Now, we see how the media is dealing with Yemen as the unforgotten war, and suddenly everybody remembers it when there is one or two or a dozen of attacks against Saudi Arabia or the Emirates, and they don't see the hundreds of attacks that are hitting Yemen for the last 7 years. That's really the way mainstream media is dealing with it, because they don't want to upset Saudi Arabia, because there is a lot of money involved from the Saudi in different countries, and because we see the United States, Canada, Germany, France, Italy, they all supplying Saudi Arabia with weapons to be used only against Yemen, because this is the only place that the Saudis are using their weapons, and they are very much aware of it, but they don't speak about it because they don't want to be involved in this humanitarian crisis, hiding behind their finger, not knowing that they are indeed responsible for every single crime against humanity that is committed in Yemen.
Well, we need to break this open in terms of the UAE role played in this war in Yemen, Hossein al-Bukhaiti. We know that it is part of the Saudi-led coalition at this point, involved in the bombing in one form or another. But there is another role that the UAE is playing that Saudi Arabia does not like. Break that open for us if you can. And that is how the UAE supports the Southern Transitional Council and its fighters, as opposed to the way that you have Saudi Arabia support what they call Yemen's President Rabah Mansour Hadi, which is not the case. Yemenis actually don't accept him or hold him legitimate. What is going on there? Why has there been a divergence there when it comes to the UAE and Saudi Arabia, particularly about the Southern Transitional Council?
The United Arab Emirates is a direct toll of United Kingdom, and we know that United Kingdom, it was occupying south of Yemen. That's why they have now more interest in the country. And as they say in England, or when they conquer in Yemen or other country, they say divide and conquer. And this is exactly what the United Arab Emirates is doing. I mean, United Arab Emirates role in Yemen is more dirtier than Saudi Arabia, because, if you were going to look at least Saudi, it says that support the so-called Hadi legitimacy, which is they call him as the president of Yemen. But on the other hand, we see that the United Arab Emirates is supporting those separatists. They are building airport. They are misusing and damaging Yemeni port. They are actually stealing fish from Yemen. They are stealing everything, especially as an example in Socotra. This means that they are actually want this war. They want to stay in Yemen. They want to divide Yemen. And as well, they are fighting the so-called legitimacy or Hadi that they the many time in Aden and other area they have fought. They have used Al-Qaeda. They have used ISIS. So the role, if it's not like Saudi Arabia, actually is more, they are more involved in Yemen. And we've seen the amount of weapons that was handed by United Arab Emirates to the so-called the separatists in south of Yemen. That's why I believe if Yemeni army will extend its attack, especially against United Arab Emirates, I'm sure that United Arab is so weak, and it will bring it to its knee, and it will stop the war against Yemen. And we have seen those many condemnation today against this attack show you that over 200,000 airstrike on Yemen, there isn't any single condemnation, especially from the United Nations or any other country. Even though, we remember when they targeted the funeral hall in Sana'a, killing more than 1,000 Yemeni civilians and injuring more than 1,000 Yemeni civilians, United Nations has called it an incident. That's why Yemeni army should step its attack despite what kind of condemnation coming from a country who actually selling weapons to United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia.
Sure. But I need to have Elijah Magner, you tell us about what is perhaps or most arguably one of the most underreported aspects of this war, and that is the goal that the UAE has had on Socotra Island, taking that over and then bringing on, after the formal announcement of this so-called normalization of ties with Israel, bringing Israel on board, making that island in what was reported to be a spying center. But aside from that, how that's going to connect that part, which is very strategic, to other ports, for example, in Africa, with Israel on the UAE's back. Tell us the relationship there that exists between the UAE, Israel, and the purpose Socotra Island and the ports serve for whatever intentions they have.
This is absolutely a very good question. Indeed, the role of the Emirates has been very noticed in the last years since the normalization with Israel and the intensive relationship that came to the surface. However, this relationship is not new. So what the Emiratis are doing in Yemen is really to protect the navigation and the interests of the Israelis in the island of Socotra and also on Bab el-Mandeb, because they are supporting 100% the Zionist regime, and they are acting on behalf of the interests of Israel in the Middle East and elsewhere. So if you look at the Emiratis per se, they have no interest in being in Yemen or expanding their forces and their presence to create an area of influence, because this is not a big country. It's a very small country based on a bit of business and wealthy people there. Mm-hmm. They have oil, and that's their role. And now they've taken upon the role of being the the shield for the Israelis, and the avant-garde of the Israeli interest in the Middle East, to really race any other country in the area of supporting Israel, hence their presence in Yemen for that purpose. And we see the visit they are coming, they are holding with the Iranians, thinking that they can compensate of their relationship with Israel. Well, the Iranians said it clearly, if you want to stop the war in Yemen, you have to go and talk to the Yemeni, accept a ceasefire and lift the siege and get out of the country, because this is not your country and you're occupying it. And it seems now with the Yemeni attack, perhaps the Emiratis got the message, and maybe it will serve them for another couple of years and stay away, as they've done after the Stockholm Agreement when they were bombed by the Houthis.
Okay, last question. Hossein Aboukhaiti, did the UAE get the message, as our guests there said? Less than a minute.
With you, I don't think they will get the message, because today attack Yemeni forces have tried, I think, to avoid, as an example, to target the industrial site in Abu Dhabi directly, or as well to target the oil field. There are a huge oil field like the so-called Zakam, and as well Bouhassa and others. If Yemeni army, if United Arab Emirates will continue its war, I believe that those major oil sites will be under attack. And after that, United Arab Emirates and their reputation around the war as a hub for international companies will be destroyed. But we still, if they're going to do that and they're going to stop, there will be no more attack. But I don't think they will do that, only if Yemeni will hit hard. Sure. Inside United Arab Emirates.
Thank you. Thank you for that. We're fresh out of time. Hossein Aboukhaiti from Sana'a there, activist and political analyst. Many thanks. And Elijah Magnier, thank you for your contribution from Brussels, journalist and political analyst. And that is it for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikoa Tarbay, entire team, this goodbye until next time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we discussed Imam Khomeini's recommendations on political groups, especially MKO terrorist organization, and said that he had advised all terrorist groups to return back to the ocean of the Iranian nation and stop acts of terror to satisfy their masters in the West or the East. In this episode, we are going to touch upon his stance on leftist and separatist groups. Stay tuned, please. Concurrent with the victory of the Russian Revolution of 1917 and coming to power of communist ideology in the country, leftist thoughts grew in many countries, particularly in the neighbors of Soviet Union, including Iran. Though the religious fabric of Iran and the sensitivity of the ruling system never led them to spread much among masses. Today Party was the most important organized group among the leftist groups which came to existence in Iran after the Second World War. This party was eradicated in two phases. First, after the assassination attempt against the Shah in Tehran University, and then in the post-1953 coup period. Thus, its leaders and advocates escaped or were tortured or executed. A few of them also turned into spies of the regime through the pressures and temptations of the Shah agents. In 1960s, due to the increase of partisan struggles inspired by the thoughts of Che Guevara, Mao and Castro, and closure of political climate in Iran, some youth and students started armed struggles against the Shah. They intended to spread armed and partisan struggles to the whole society a la China and Cuba to topple the regime. But the Shah regime was fully supported by the U.S. As a result, the members of such groups would soon be identified and repressed before taking any serious measure. These groups were totally destroyed in late 1960s and early 1970s. At that time, the regime of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi was in its most powerful days, thanks to the exorbitant oil revenues and relying on security and military support of the U.S. and allies. In such circumstances, Imam Khomeini started his struggle against the Shah and the U.S. with trust in God and relying on people's all-out support. Millions of men and women from all walks of life answered positively to Imam Khomeini's call to show their opposition to the regime of Shah. Therefore, they poured to the streets and chanted anti-regime slogans. The Imam's all-encompassing umbrella had indeed covered all political parties and every social stratum. Thus, the Islamic Revolution triumphed in a few months to the bewilderment of all analysts. Without doubt, the key element in this victory was the unmatched personality of Imam Khomeini and his charismatic leadership. The course of the revolution left no choice for political parties but to join the masses even if they didn't believe in the ideology and ideals of the Imam and the people. This was the means for most of them to survive. The leftist groups had no belief in Islam, but had to join the people to survive. However, after the victory, they started to act as opposition and counter-revolutionary elements. They left no stone unturned to hurt the Islamic Revolution. Imam Khomeini time and again advised them to return to the Islamic Revolution and the Iranian nation. But they insisted on their stubborn thoughts and were finally exterminated. The Imam writes in his testament, "My recommendation to the leftists, like communists and Fadaye Khalq partisans and other groups with leftist tendencies, is that without proper studying of ideologies and the ideology of Islam, with those who are well aware of ideologies, especially Islam, which motive has satisfied you to be inclined to the ideology,
that has failed in the world today? And what has happened that you have become content with few isms, whose content is null with researchers? What has motivated you to intend to draw your country to the lap of the Soviet or China and to fight your nation in the name of love of two-day party or hatch plots to the benefit of foreigners against your country and oppressed masses? Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, addressing leftist groups, writes in his testament, "You can see that since the onset of communism, its masqueraders have been the most dictatorial, the most power-seeking, and the most monopolist governments in the world. What nations were smashed and annihilated under the rule of the Soviet, claiming to support masses? The Russian nation, Muslims and non-Muslims, have been struggling with twitches under the pressure of the Communist Party and are denied any freedom and are living in suffocation worse than that of the world dictators. Stalin, who was one of the so-called bright figures of the party, we were witness to his coming and going and his protocols and aristocracy. Now that you, the Beagle, are sacrificing your life for that regime, the oppressed people of the Soviet and its satellites like Afghanistan are dying of their oppressions." Imam Khomeini continues to advise the leftists, "You who are claiming the advocacy of people, what crimes you have committed against these people wherever you could, as with the noble people of Amol, who you wrongly called your strong advocates and sent many of them deceptively to fight people and the government to be killed. You want to offer the Iranian oppressed and deprived nation to the Soviet dictatorship, and you are doing this treason under the guise of Fadai-e Khalq and advocates of the deprived. The Two-Day Party and its cohorts are doing this through conspiracy under the mask of supporting the Islamic Republic, while other groups are doing it through arms, terror, and blasts." Imam Khomeini writes in continuation, "I write as testament to you, parties and groups, either those who are known as leftists or those who are feeding from and inspired by the West, or even those such as Democratic or Komole parties who take arms in the name of autonomy and advocacy of Kurds and Baluch, and have destroyed the deprived people of Kurdistan and other places, and prevent cultural, hygiene, and economic services and reconstruction by the government on those provinces to join the nation. Now that they have experienced that they have done nothing and cannot do anything but making the inhabitants miserable, so it is to their benefit and that of the nations and regions to assist the government and give up rebellion, serving the foreigners and betrayal of their country. They should embark on building the country and be sure that Islam is better for them than both the criminal Western Pole and the dictatorial Eastern Pole, and it will fulfill the humane wishes of people better."
voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.